Now I call upon Brother Jeff then to speak to us upon his subject, creation, not evolution. Brother Jeff. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And already, 17th day of January, amazing. But the snow's on the ground, so everything as we would expect. Creation, not evolution. And those words in Genesis, how majestic they are. And straightway, there's the challenge to modern man. In the beginning, God. More than that, in the beginning, God created. And we as Christadelphians, we take those words as fact, and we're happy to read on into the rest of verse 1 and all the other verses that follow on in the wondrous book known as the Bible. God created, and we learn of his creation, and particularly his purpose with man, desperate state that man's in, and God's solution as we go through from book to book. But as we come down Genesis chapter 1, day by day we have those various creative acts, and we stopped at the fifth day because it's on the fifth day that the Lord creates the birds that fill the sky and the fish that fill the waters. And I've highlighted in red that fact, that the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creatures that have life. And even in these days of overfishing and terrible pollution, there's still some staggering sights of shoals of fish. And one can imagine in previous times an even greater abundance. Life in so many different forms, in so many different ways. Cold waters, warm water, shallow and deep. The seas just wonderfully blessed. And we read there, every living creature that moveth, which the waters bring forth abundantly after their kind. And so we learn from straight away from Genesis 1, and this is true of the birds, it's true of all his creations, of all the life forms, that in making the first ones, the next generation, we're told, is the same. After their kind, there's a particular type, and it's reproduced exactly the same. So there's no room here for evolution. And I'm going to talk about one creature in particular today, and it'd be fairly easy for you to guess what that creature might be. It's obviously a fish. I've been concentrating on those verses in Genesis about the waters. Anyone like to say what fish that is? It is a salmon. Now before we go any further, anyone allergic to salmon? I've actually met one or two that are allergic to eating salmon. I think it's fantastic. But there you are. Has anyone caught a salmon before I go and embarrass myself? No one's actually caught a salmon by net? By rod? Oh, well, we're all agreed on that. Some 30 years ago, I went fishing with Dermot Heffernan. I've sadly fallen asleep now, but I went out with Dermot twice. Crossed the River Suir, quite a wide river there outside Waterford, and he had a drift net, and you have this drift net goes right across the width of the river. It takes a long time to get the net out. I helped, inverted commas. I basically watched Dermot do it all. But anyway, you put the net out, and then the net drifted down the river with the tide, and then you bring the net back in, and hopefully there'll be salmon there. Two times I did it, no salmon. Most disappointed. I was hoping Kevin would be here, because Kevin would bound to be shouting, yeah, there was one. Did he get one, Jay? Oh, great. Not too many, I hope. So that's the nearest I've got to catching a salmon. But at Dermot's parents' house, his father was fishing quite often illegally, it has to be said. I can remember going round there, and outside in the backyard there was a box with really big salmon, about five or six salmon. And there was a lot of joy in the house, because even those days in the early 80s, to get a big sum was money. But I've digressed too much. This woman here is remarkable because she holds the British record. So of all the men that you see fishing canal side, river bank, all the men that you see, and the ladies will love this, I'm sure, For all those men you see, the inland British record belongs to Miss Georgina Ballantyne. On the 7th of October 1922, she caught that salmon, which weighed 64 pounds. She caught one earlier in the day, I think that was about 30 or 40 pounds. So it wasn't altogether a fluke, she knew what she was doing. And there's another lady, a couple of years after, catches one at 62 pounds on a fly, which is quite significant. Anyway, the salmon, that's what we're going to talk about. And what's so impressive about the salmon, it's not that we get big ones like that occasionally, it's its amazing life cycle. Now, I don't believe this life cycle has come together by chance, such as evolutionists would have us to believe. I think the whole process, which is a long and lengthy one, is of God and of design. Now, starting at the top there with the eggs, they're laid in fresh water upstream. Take about 3 months before they come to hatching. The temperatures have to be right and so on. There's quite a science in that of itself. And then we have this young fish that feeds off the yolk sac, an alevin. And then it gets into a real fish-like form and independent of that sac. 5 to 10 weeks old and it's swimming, and then it gets a little bit bigger. And you notice these fish get different names at different times in the cycle when they get a par, which has distinctive finger markings. Quite pretty fish, actually. And then between 1 and 3 years, so it might be just 1 year old, it might be as much as three, we're having fish, which is quite a powerful specimen, and they'll shoal together as smolts. And although they've been up to this point freshwater fish, they make their way out to the estuary and then out into the open sea, and miraculously they become saltwater fish. And they'll be in the seas I've got there on the chart down here from 1 to 8 years. I don't know why that varies so much, but apparently it does. And they get bigger and bigger. All fish, by the way, continually grow. Just the way it is, they just continually grow until the day of their demise. So these salmon get bigger and bigger, and then after about 8 years, or maybe a little bit earlier, they do a remarkable thing. They turn around and they go back. And they're thousands of miles out into the sea, and they come back. If they originated from British waters, they come back to British waters. And the males will change colour for the spawning time. This is a male, get a hooked sort of mouth. It doesn't look quite so attractive to me now. And they'll come back to spawn. And once they've done that, the males will all die. A lot of the females die too. But some actually survive. And then you've got the eggs that have been laid prior to that, of course. And the whole cycle goes round. And that cycle would take 2 years, maybe 10. Now just think about this now. Fresh water, then salt water. And if you kept tropical fish? I know Sue has. you wouldn't put cold water fish in a hurry in a tropical tank, although you can get away with it to some degree. But to put marine fish in fresh water, not a good idea. All sorts of nasty things can happen. And so most fish either live in seawater and that's it, or they live in fresh water and that's it. You get some that live in brackish water, but they just stay in that type of salty water, but not full seawater as such, they'll stay there. There's not many that go from one to the other. The salmon does, and it goes one way, remember, and then it goes back and does it the other way. Does it twice over. Now for seawater, because the salinity of the seawater is much greater than the body fluids, the fish loses water to the saltier environment. I don't want to get too scientific, but fish in the sea are forever drinking water because they're forever losing water. This is the process of osmosis. You might have vaguely remembered that at school. And they have to conserve food, so they hardly ever urinate. And salt is excreted by the gills. So their gills are specialised in dealing with the salt problem. So that's what happens with seawater fish. Now, you take freshwater fish, it's the other way around. The salinity of the water is much less than that of the fish's body fluids. And so the body gains water this time from the surrounding environment. It's the other way around. So a freshwater fish keeps its mouth shut, might surprise you. It doesn't drink very much. And it's gaining water through its body by osmosis, as I've got on the diagram. Salt this time has been absorbed by the gills because it needs the salt. And it urinates all the time. So you can keep freshwater fish, you know, the good old goldfish, you're forever changing the goldfish bowl water. You just have to keep on doing it because it keeps fouling it. Now, I hope that hasn't been too scientific for you. I hope that's just been simple enough, but not too trite enough. I hope it's been okay for you to see there's quite a difference here in what's going on. You put the two together there. This is complex. And this is about getting the water balance right, the salt balance is right. It's about the fish exploding or imploding. That's what can happen if it's in the wrong place. So a salmon, how wondrous it is, starts off as a freshwater fish and behaves like that we've got on the top of that slide. It then goes out into the seawater and it changes its behaviour, and within itself it changes so it can take on the role of a seawater fish. Actually, I got the up and downs wrong there, didn't I? It starts off at the freshwater there on the bottom, then on the top of the seawater. And then it may be out in the seawater for as much as 8 years, a long, 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 long time. And it's got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it gets to a point, and it comes back into fresh water, and it has to go and do things completely different. Stop drinking, urinate, start absorbing the salt through the gills, so on and so forth. Now, I don't believe this is all happened by chance. For it to happen once is remarkable. To have it happening again the other way around, doubly so. For the cycle of the salmon to work, there's so much intricate processes going on, complicated things happening here, that it has to work straight off first time, first cycle, and God is the author of it, and one cycle leads to another cycle to another, and each cycle's the same. Just a matter of time changes. Now, just as we're fearfully and wonderfully made, so are fish. And you can see in that diagram, their gills, their heart, you know, the heart, the stomach and so on, liver, it's all there. I just want to talk a little bit about respiration, how they breathe. Don't have any thought about how fish breathe. You might say, well, they breathe through the gills, Jeff. Okay. But have you thought how wondrous that is? Oxygen in our air is 21%. Water, it's 1%. All life forms need oxygen. So fish have got to get this oxygen out of the water, and yet really there's so much of it, so little of it dissolved. Less than 1%. So gills are amazing things, and again, for sake of time, I won't dwell too long on this. Fish, in taking water in, the water goes through its gills, but at the same time, there's a contra flow. Deoxygenated blood is moved up to the gills, so that blood needs to be oxygenated. Water comes in through the mouth, through the gills, which is with oxygen, and there's a transfer. The diagram shows something of that, what's going on. And so the gills are highly specialised, extracting that precious oxygen out of the water. A salmon has four set of gills, and I don't know if the picture does it justice here, but you can see how bloody these are. Because of that blood is going to take in that oxygen. And a salmon is pretty good at it. You take up to 70% of the oxygen dissolved in the water. 70%, you know, that is really, remarkable. And furthermore, it has to deal with cold water, which tends to have more oxygen in it, warm water, which has less. O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of all thy riches. You take stock of what's happening here and you just marvel at it. You're like the psalmist. Migration. Yeah, obviously the salmon moves. And they move vast distances. The salmon round the British Isles will go north, Faroe Islands, up to Iceland, but then it'll go out west, right out as far as Greenland, as you can see on that diagram, long distances. And just want to take you now to my beloved island, as it were. I haven't been here, I've got enough money, but there's Delphi Lodge in County Galway, where there's a bit of a resort. And one of the things they do there specialises in trout and salmon fishing. And I just want to explain to you a little bit of migration from there. Last summer, a lot of big salmon were caught in that river. There's one example. I would have been proud of got one of those. Lovely specimen. Now, where we're talking about now, I'm pointing, here we are. See that blob up there, about halfway down, is where we are. And the owner of the lodge, who's made a lot of money, he's now got another fishing resort in Bermuda. That's how well he's done. Has recently put on the internet this information. Tag smolts, remember smolts are the ones that go out of the rivers and moving out into the sea. Tag smolts from Delphi, this is where we are in County Galway, were netted by a research vessel off the Faroe Islands, 400 miles away, 30 days after release into the freshwater lake in front of Delphi Lodge. There's the lodge, if you haven't noticed, there it is. So they tagged these fish down here, and note it says, and 2 miles from the sea. So they're 2 miles away from the sea. So the fish has gone out from there, 2 miles, out into the open sea, month later, found off the Faroe Islands, 400 miles away. So they go vast distances and they can do it quickly, remarkably quick. You know, it's an average of 13 miles a day, swept along by the currents and so on. And he goes on to say, this man who's obviously become quite an expert in salmon, migration is not primarily by ocean temperature, salinity, or the depth, as we once thought. These are ideas that were put forward. They're now suggesting, and I think it's still guesswork, I have to tell you, he says, but rather by the stars and internal compasses sensitive to local changes in the Earth's magnetic field. Magnetic particles in the fish's lateral stripes may function as compasses. Now, how dare anyone talk in those terms and not think of one greater than ourselves? Now, he may well believe in God. I don't know. I don't know his religious persuasion or non-religious persuasion at all. But when I read things like that, you know, wow, what is going on? How do they do it? He's talking there about the lateral line. I hope you can see it. Can you see that on the salmon here? See that? When I used to catch fish as a youngster, I always used to be quite interested in that lateral line, but it was just to me, it was just a mark of beauty. I didn't think anything more than that. I had no idea that it had any great function with the fish. I just thought it was a nice, interesting marking on it. But a lateral line is so important to a fish, and there's a whole science in this, and I don't get too bogged down on it. But forgetting that idea of picking up the magnetic field with the salmon for a moment, this is true of all fish that have lateral lines. This is true of all lateral line systems. They are so vital to the fish because by the lateral line, they know what's around them. They pick up the vibration and the movement in the surrounding water. So you can see this diagram here, and this nerve is so important. And then you've got this here that's expanded up for us, the nerves and all the rest of it. water displacement, water comes in, and you've probably read all that up the top. Electric signal goes to the fish's brain, the fish interprets that, and knows whether to move this way or that way, go backwards or forward, sideways, whatever. Now, how did that happen? How did that come? Did it come of the fish of itself? I think not. Created like that, wonderfully. This is a sophisticated feature that fish have. And what they're suggesting now about the salmon, as well as the salmon being able to pick up movement and vibration of the water, and know what it's around it, is actually within the lateral line somehow can pick up the magnetic force. And know from the magnetic field where it is. And they talk of it having some guidance by that means. Amazing. Now, near the coast and in the rivers, salmon are guided by chemical memory. I don't think many would argue with this. The evidence for this seems to be quite overwhelming. I won't go through it now, but I've looked it up and it's clear this is going on. And by that chemical memory, they recognise pheromones present in the water in very minute traces. Now, again, it's quite mind-boggling. You think of the sea, the movement of the sea and all the rest of it. Think of a river for that matter, but you just think of the sea. We're talking about a creature that can pick up the tiniest change in chemical disposition of that water. Just got it. And it can do it having been away from that river maybe 8 years. That's what we learned at the beginning. It could be out of the sea for 8 years. The vast majority of salmon go back to the very river, the same river that they originated from. The same river, the same brook even, it'll go up. And I hope you can see. They caught one of fish, it's always called the nair. But there's the nostril. And for all the wonders of the gills and the lateral line, that's pretty marvellous too, isn't it? Wonderful. It's only a fish. You know, you think how complicated we are. It's only a fish. People have been eating salmon for thousands of years. Most of them. It's only a fish. Mind you, if it's a nice big one, I can catch and get some money for it. And they're still trying to poach salmon in Ireland now, I'm sure. But there are. Those nostrils pick up the pheromones and those very minute traces and know where they're going. And just when you think Jeff's finished, there's one more thing I want to talk to you about. And that's the leap. The leap. And there's one in flight. It's up the River Tyne. It's a returning salmon. Been years away, but it's going up the Tyne because its parents laid the eggs, all the spawning took place those years before up the Tyne, and he's going back up the Tyne. Hadn't ever been there before other than as a very young fish, and then as a smolt it came out, and for years it's been away. Might have been up by the Faroes, Iceland, might have been off Greenland. And here it is, now jumping. And there's a drive within the fish. No stopping it. And if it can't get over that barrier, it stays where it is and it dies where it is. It's got to get up that barrier. It's got to get over that weir or whatever it might be. And most of them do. And for the males, there's another reason why so many of them die, because the exhaustion for a big fish to achieve it. Now, anybody know what the high jump record is for men at the moment? It's been long standing, actually. I think it's one of the most long standing athletic records that we've got. Both the women's record has been standing a long time for the ladies here. Long time, it's there to be broken. And the man's one's been there 10, 15 years. Anybody know what it is? I'll accept imperial or metric.
7.5 feet.
It's actually a bit better than that. That takes us to about 1962, I think. So. It's actually, I can't remember the metric very well, despite what I just said, but I can remember the British version. 8.5 feet. 8.5 feet, right? That's the high jump record for a man. I've got to say, women, I haven't got over 7 foot yet. 6'11¼. 8 foot, just over. How about a salmon? I'll tell you in a moment. Well, how do they jump at all? There's a whole world of mathematics in how they're able to get out of that water. Try to explain to it simply, because it gets too complicated for me for one good reason. The deeper the pool below the falls, the better the takeoff angle, faster the fish can go, and higher the fish can leap. I mean, that's fair enough, isn't it? So you need a real deep trough below that weir. Deeper it is, fish can go faster into it, get a better angle of takeoff. Okay? But there's also something called the standing wave or the hydraulic jack. It'd probably be better if I just read the whole paragraph out and then we'll have a little think over it. It all depends on the position of what is referred to in engineering terms as the standing wave or hydraulic jack. The water falling from a ledge above hits the water surface below and continues to plunge deep below the surface. Then under pressure from more plummeting water, the water rushes back up to the surface and the fish comes up with it. Fantastic. That's how it works. Now, I think it's a couple of years ago now, we're down near Cardigan and the River Teffy inland a little bit. There's a weir there, in October time, salmon leap, and Helen and myself saw a few salmon jump in. Not as spectacular as it can be in Scotland. You've seen salmon jump in? Willis has. Where were they? Salmon?
Scotland.
In Scotland there. And we've seen 3, 4, 5 at a time, or one every now and then?
There was quite a few over a period of an hour at least. Watch,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you get half a dozen all in one go. We would sort of see one and leave it 10 minutes and then you see another. And they're only doing 3 or 4 feet. Still amazing to see. And a lot of people go just to watch. Quite a thing. There's a male. You can see it's a male. You know why it's a male? Look at that hook on its mouth and the coloration. And there's the record. For Scotland, highest jump a salmon has been known to make in Scotland is a vertical one of 12 feet at the Orrin Falls in Rosshon. What's the record for a human being? You haven't been listening. Don't forget the half. Salmon, 12 feet. How's he doing it? For all the hydraulic jack explanation, for all the getting the angle right and going at a tremendous speed, I can't get my head around how that fish can somehow spring and do that. But they do. Wondrously, they do. And so they're my thoughts on the salmon to share with you this morning. I see something like that, I just get into its life cycle a little bit, and there's more you can delve into. I just wonder at it, from the migration, the distances it goes, the fact that it changes from freshwater to seawater, the wonder of its gills, and then even down to that loop. I mean, it's just amazing. How can anyone say this all happened by a throw of the dice, a throw of the dice, a throw of the dice, over and over again, keep getting six? Well, now I used to play Monopoly, I could never get 2 sixes. Not straight away, anyway. So many things are expected of us to accept if we take evolution. And it happens once. It's got to happen again and again and again and again. That cycle was achieved at the outset once, and it's set in motion, and that cycle will never ever be frustrated unless one thing, arrogant man, gets in the way. And there are one or two barriers in fresh waters that ought not to be. And there's seas that are polluted, and so on and so forth. This man actually corrupts the system. But let's end as these wonderful men in faith in Nehemiah pray unto God. Thou, even thou, art Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and all things that are therein, the seas and all that is therein. And thou preservest them all, and the host of heaven worshipeth thee.
On your behalf, I would thank Brother Jeff for his very interesting remarks on the fantastic life cycle of the salmon, which clearly shows the hand of God at work in his creation. We'll now conclude our meeting in prayer and give thanks for the refreshments. Lord God, once more we would draw nigh unto thee to again praise and to magnify thy great and holy name, and to acknowledge thee as the only true and living God, the creator and sustainer of all life that we see. And we thank thee for this morning hour where we have been able to once more reflect on thy creative works in the life of a salmon, and indeed all of thy creation. So Lord God, we ask for thy blessing to be wherever thy word is preached in sincerity and in truth. And we now thank thee for the refreshments that we're about to partake. May they indeed strengthen us and encourage us to seek more of thee and of thy plan and purpose with the earth. For we ask this prayer in Jesus' name.